This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump and the mayor of Portland, Oregon, have engaged in a public war of words over the mayor's handling of police brutality protests, which have turned violent. Portland has seen 3 months of nightly protests since the May 25th death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody, most recently the Saturday shooting death of a person during one of the events. In a series of tweets, the president criticized Mayor Ted Wheeler and urged him again to request help from the federal government law enforcement. Saturday's shooting came after a caravan of right-wing activists drove into the downtown area where they were confrontations with protesters, according to videos posted on social media. The U.S. state of Kentucky's attorney general has received a ballistics report in the controversial Breonna Taylor case, AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
Kentucky's attorney general has received a long-awaited ballistics report in the police shooting of Breonna Taylor. AG Daniel Cameron tweeted Sunday that there is additional analysis needed now that the report is in his hands. He adds there will be no announcement on the investigation this week. Cameron has indicated the ballistics report has slowed the investigation into Taylor's death by police on March 13th. Taylor was shot while at home by police serving a narcotics warrant. Cameron has faced intense pressure from activists who want the officers charged in the Taylor killing. I'm Shelley Antler.
Authorities say a St. Louis police officer who was shot in the head while responding to a shooting on the city's south side has died. The 29-year-old Tamaris Bohannon had been with the department for nearly 4 years. A second officer who was shot in the leg Sunday was treated and released after the shooting around 6 p.m. in the South Grand neighborhood. This is VOA News. Worldwide, there are more than 845,000 COVID-19-related deaths now, more than 25.1 million confirmed infections, with just four countries, the United States, Brazil, India, and Russia, carrying the bulk of the cases. The state at the epicenter of Australia's second wave of COVID-19 infection said Monday that the number of new cases fell to near two-month lows, allowing authorities to detail in a week's time how stringent lockdown measures will be lifted. Victoria said it has detected 73 new COVID-19 infections in the past 24 hours, the lowest since July 3rd. The easing number of COVID-19 cases comes as the state capital, Melbourne, begins its fourth week of a six-week lockdown that sees residents confined in their homes, a nightly curfew imposed, and large parts of the state economy ordered to close. On the day Belarus's embattled president, Alexander Lukashenko, turned 66, he received a call from Russian President Vladimir Putin inviting Lukashenko to visit Moscow, a sign of the Kremlin's willingness to back Lukashenko as he grapples with the unrest and the threat of new Western sanctions. Once again, tens of thousands of protesters flooded the capital to call for Lukashenko's resignation. He has been struggling to contain the weeks of protests and strikes since winning an August 9th election his opponents say were rigged. He denies electoral fraud and has said the protests are back from abroad. Top U.S. Democrats say they may subpoena intelligence officials to testify on election security after the director of national intelligence stops in-person briefings. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Senator Amy Klobuchar says she's outraged at Intelligence Director John Ratcliffe's decision over what he calls leaks.
I think the House is going to have to subpoena the Director of Intelligence in order to get information, which is crazy.
She also tells ABC's This Week monitoring foreign interference should be paramount. President Trump was asked about it Saturday at a hurricane briefing in Texas and said Ratcliffe is right.
You have leakers on the committee. Leakers that are doing bad things, probably not even legal to leak.
Trump did not offer details. Ratcliffe said lawmakers will get written updates. I'm Julie Walker.
And you can find more at voanews.com. Again, that is voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, August 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's Transitional Council and armed movements are expected to sign a comprehensive peace agreement today, Monday.
What we need as the people of Sudan, we are looking to have a constructive engagement with the government to address the genuine issues that related to the conflict.
Campaigning is underway in Tanzania's October election, but the main opposition Chadema is crying foul. Malawi's president bemoans men's laxity on COVID-19 prevention measures. The IOM says more than 300,000 people are displaced in Chad's Lekki province. And Mali's military leaders have met with the protest movement to discuss a transition process.
I think for the military in Mali, the situation is more complicated because they want to lead the process. And this is what M5 is against, and even ECOWAS head of state.
A Kenya lift ban on importation of secondhand clothes. But those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council and the armed movements are expected to sign a comprehensive peace agreement today, Monday, in the South Sudan capital, Juba. South Sudan has been mediating the peace process. Today's signing is now expected to include areas controlled by SPLM North leader Abdel Aziz Al-Hilu. Al-Hilu withdrew from the talks because he said the Sudan government refused to include the issue of Sudan as a secular state. The government said the issue of secular state should be brought up during a constitutional conference. Ahmed Tuga Lisan is the chief negotiator for the Justice and Equality Movement. He says reference to secular state and Sharia are old issues that the opposition used against the former Bashir government, but which do not seem to apply to the new government of today.
Well, I think this is an old language that's been used by the Sudanese opposition against the old regime. But since the revolution took place in Sudan, and the people changed the government and a new civilian government came to power, there is no longer, you know, the issue of Sharia, Islam and secularism. These are not the priority of the people of Sudan. And what Abdulaziz is asking for is absolutely not going to happen in Sudan because he's asking for something that's not there. But this will clearly indicate whether Abdulaziz himself is ready to sign a peace agreement or genuinely he wants to engage in a constructive peace process in order to resolve the conflict in the Nuba Mountains.
The transitional government has said that the issue of secular state should be referred to the constitutional conference. Is that okay?
Exactly. That's what we did in our agreement with the government. As long as we are going to have a constitutional conference, not only by Abdulaziz or by ourselves or by the government, but all the people of Sudan, they are going to come to this constitutional conference and agree on all the agendas of the conference and the issues that need to be dealt with in the conference. And no doubt that the religion and the state and the relationship between the politics and the religion should be addressed properly, not by Abdulaziz or by agreements, but by the will of the people of Sudan in a comprehensive constitutional conference. And then from there, all the people of Sudan can agree on whether, or determine the relationship between state and religion clearly. So this is what it should be done, not in a way that Abdulaziz is asking for, or this cannot be happened. It's impossible. You cannot achieve this through a peace process.
If the agreement is going to be signed on Monday, does that mean that your movement will be ready to join the current transitional government?
Yes, there's no doubt. All the signatories of this agreement are going to be part of the government in a short time, and they are going to be members at the executive, the legislative, and the sovereign council, and all the organs of the government. So, and this is also available for Abdulaziz if he wants to join. That's okay. Otherwise, people are not going to wait for Abdulaziz or keep, the whole process hostage to his own desires.
We are very happy to speak with you, and thank you for making the time.
Okay, thank you.
Ahmed Tuga Lisan is the chief negotiator for the Justice and Equality Movement. He was speaking with us from London. Mali's military leaders have met with the opposition M5RFP protest movement to discuss a transition process that would see the country return to civilian rule. Reports say the protest movement has proposed a transition period of 18 to 24 months. But the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has said that any transition period should not exceed 12 months. ECOWAS has also said that such transitions should not be led by any active military person. Senegalese human rights activist Ibrahima Khan says the issue of who should lead the transitional process appears to be a point of disagreement between the military and the protest movement.
I think what happened is that on Friday evening, the military released a communique through which it was inviting on Saturday morning a number of groups that were involved in the unrest in Mali in terms of mobilizing population and also trying to get involved in the next phase. But in the list of group that was released, the M5 was not included. And I think it was a big mistake. And the meeting between M5 and the army was correct, that mistake, and to really try to find a way of really discussing their respective role in the new phase that is opening from tomorrow.
We were told initially that when the M5 met with the military junta, they were proposing a transition process of 18 to 24 months. But ECOWAS is demanding that any transition should not exceed 12 months. Is there a recipe here for conflict?
Not really conflict, in my view, because I think when you decide that the transition should be 18 or 24 months, you need to explain why it should be like that. If, for example, this transition is about adopting a new constitution, explaining the process on how the constitution will be elaborated, will be discussed, and finally adopted, I think that can be well understood by the head of state who are meeting on the 7th of September. But if it is longer than 18 months, then it will look like people who are staying there for ages.
How comfortable do you think the military leaders are to this ECOWAS demand that a transitional government should not be led by any military person? Is this another flashpoint?
That is the most difficult issue to be sorted out, because I think it's clear in the mind of ECOWAS head of state, and also even it's clear in the protocol on good governance that the role of the military is not to run a country. The role of the military is to defend the country. Now, ECOWAS, I think the former president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, even said in his report that a retired general or military is accepted, but should not be an active military. And that's, for me, a red line for them. But I think for the military in Mali, the situation is more complicated, because they want to lead the process. And this is what M5 is against, and even ECOWAS head of state.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese human rights activist. You're speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. Campaigning in Tanzania's October 28th general elections enters its second week today, Monday. Incumbent President John Magufuli of the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi Party told supporters over the weekend that if he is re-elected, he will focus on boosting the country's GDP and complete several projects aimed at making Tanzania a great country. Magufuli is seeking his second five-year term. Main opposition Chadema Party candidate Tundu Lissu says his first week of campaigning went very well, except that the Elections Commission unfairly disqualified many of his party's candidates for local council and parliament.
What has happened during the nomination day and the 3-4 days after is nothing short of a scandal. Here is the deal. We in my party placed 3,754 candidates for municipal authorities, for district councils, and so on and so forth, countrywide. That's close to 97% of all the positions that are being contested. Now, between nomination day and today, over 1,000 of our candidates, a third of them have been disqualified on completely bogus grounds. So what is clear is the ruling party and the government do not want any election. They want a coronation. Now, the story is not just of civic candidates, parliamentary candidates. Out of 244 candidates that we placed countrywide, and that is, again, close over 90% of all the positions that are in contest.
So you are calling for peaceful demonstrations. When will these demonstrations take place? And do you think a peaceful demonstration will make a difference?
Well, peaceful demonstrations are just one form of public pressure on the authorities. But we're also calling on all people of goodwill in Tanzania and our friends outside Tanzania to put pressure to bear on the regime, on the government, to reverse this disastrous course that they have taken. We are asking the friends of Tanzania internationally to apply sanctions, to take punitive action against the government and the officials concerned if they do not reverse themselves on this important matter. All we are asking for is for the opportunity to compete in an election. We are not saying our people should necessarily be elected. We are saying they should have opportunity to be voted for, to be defeated, if need be, at the ballot box and not on these bureaucrats' desks.
You're trying to unseat President Magufuli. He promised again over the weekend that if he's re-elected, he will focus on boosting the country's economy and making Tanzania a great nation again.
President Magufuli has literally destroyed the country's economy. If he is re-elected, he will finish off whatever remains of what you might call an economy. He will take us the way of Zimbabwe, of Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe.
Tundu Lissu is the presidential candidate for Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dodoma. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, August 31st. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has asked men in Malawi to strictly follow COVID-19 prevention measures. In his weekly national address on Saturday, Chakwera said government statistics indicate that more men in the country are infected with the virus than women. The president said this is largely because of the reckless behavior of many men in Malawi in observing measures aimed at stopping the spread of COVID-19. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Chakwera said he is deeply concerned that most men in Malawi feel they are very strong and cannot contract the coronavirus. Chakwera says, I am not concerned over this because I am a man. No. But the pandemic has shown that more people who are infected with coronavirus are men. Because in every 10 confirmed cases, 7 of them are men. Recent statistics from the Public Health Institute of Malawi also show that 64% of confirmed COVID-19 cases are men. Chakwera has therefore sent a special appeal to men in Malawi to start strictly observing measures against the spread of COVID-19, which include the wearing of face coverings, washing hands with soap, or applying hand sanitizers, and observing social distance. Chakwera says, on behalf of all men, I should say all women should be reminding us men to follow these preventive measures, because what we want is to successfully fight this pandemic to build the COVID-free new Malawi nation. Social commentator Humphreys Mvula told VOA that men in the country are at higher risk of contracting coronavirus because they are more rebellious than women. He says a large number of men in Malawi usually frequent drinking joints and are too adventurous despite the COVID-19 threat.
Conservatism in Malawian women is great. Generally, whatever the age, a Malawian woman will go from work to home, will go from school home, will go from a specific undertaking back home. And they are also very fearful. Look, well, most of them are God-fearing, more God-fearing than men.
Dorothy Ngoma, a public health expert and a health rights campaigner in Malawi, spoke to VOA on the matter.
More men tend to smoke, so their lungs are weaker. They drink a lot more. Also, when they are sick, maybe they have a fever. If it's not serious, if it's mild, they'll still go to work. Unless they are like very, very sick, they cannot get up. As opposed to women, when women are sick, they will say it loud that they are not feeling well. They will seek treatment and they will stay home.
Ngoma said there is a need to put measures in place that would help men strictly follow COVID-19 preventive measures. These measures, she says, should include imposing an instant fine on those found ignoring the guidelines. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Chad's Lake Province borders Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger. The region has been under repeated attacks since 2015, forcing millions of people to flee. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports more than 360,000 people in this part of Chad are forcibly displaced. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says new figures show a 22% increase in the number of people who have fled their homes since April. This, he says, means that over half of the region's population now is considered displaced because of the protracted insurgency.
Recurrent security attacks and incursions by non-state armed groups since the beginning of the year prompted the Chadian government in March to declare the departments of Fuli and Kaya, two of Lake Chad's borderlands departments, as war zones, complicating the forced displacement in response to these security issues. The Lake region is experiencing the highest rainfall in nearly 30 years.
IOM reports flash flooding of villages and fields have prompted nearly 12,000 people to flee between August 8th and 16th, one of the highest numbers it has ever recorded in such a short period. Dillon calls this a worrying trend, as the displacement keeps recurring with increasing frequency. He says people are facing a double security and environmental crisis amidst the COVID-19 pandemic.
3/4 of the displaced persons IOM identified live in displacement sites, most of which are made from straw and metal structures. Many of them sleep in the open without adequate protection from the ongoing, continuing bad weather, with limited access to amenities such as water, hygiene installations, health services, and COVID-19 protective equipment.
IOM is providing emergency humanitarian aid to thousands of vulnerable people, including temporary or semi-permanent shelters and non-food items, including hygiene kits, sleeping mats, and basic cooking equipment. The agency says it also is involved in a range of peace-building, community stabilization, and recovery activities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Second-hand clothes in Kenya, popularly known as mitumba, will resume importation after a 4-month ban as one of the measures to curb the spread of COVID-19. Kenyan Trade Cabinet Secretary Betty Maina said traders will be required to fumigate their goods once they land in Kenya. Second-hand clothes traders have been counting their losses because of the ban, as well as customers not buying the clothes for fear of contracting COVID-19. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Few days after President Uhuru Kenyatta lifted the ban on importation of second-hand clothes, popularly known in Kenya as mitumba, the traders will be subjected to Ministry of Health guidelines to ensure the goods are safe. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta said that all the traders will be required to abide by the guidelines given by the government once the borders are open for importation.
That the ban on the sale of second-hand clothing, otherwise known in Kenya as mitumba, is herewith lifted, and details of how this will be operated and the protocols for the same will be announced by the government.
According to Kenya's Trade Ministry, the Mitumba Association of Kenya said that the members are ready to observe all COVID-19 health protocols to ensure all products in the market are safe. Trade Cabinet Secretary Betty Maina said all second-hand clothes and shoes traders will work in conjunction with the Kenya Bureau of Standards as well as the Ministry of Health guidelines.
All importers of used clothing will register with the Bureau of Standards to help manage the trade and to ensure we have sufficient contact management. They will, and they have agreed, that they will ensure that all the goods they import will be fumigated before the in compliance with the directives from the Ministry of Health, and they will fumigate before bailing in compliance with these standards.
Benjamin Muli, a Mitumba trader toy market in Nairobi, said that it is their hope that the government will consider lowering the tax for the commodity given the losses they have incurred. He says most of the traders have consumed money for stock as others lost jobs during the period the products were banned, and that it will be better if the prices are not increased.
We are so happy that the government has opened the Mitumba. We are happy because we are going to go back to our business normal. The challenge that we had, the first thing is that the prices of the beds were so high. So for the people who had no much of the saving, they could not afford the beds. And secondly, the customers who were used to buying the Mitumbas, then they had a challenge also because, you know, most of them have lost their jobs, so the income is not steady.
Second-hand clothes and shoes are mostly consumed by majority of Kenyans since they are affordable compared to new clothes, and the ban has affected both the traders as well as the customers. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Namibia, where world governing body FIFA says having more than one top-flight football division in Namibia is unacceptable. World football governing body FIFA informed the Namibia Football Association at the weekend that it does not support the existence of a second Namibia Premier League, which was formed by expelled NPL executive committee members and several clubs. Creators of the Parallel League are seeking recognition as a national sports body or league independent of the Namibia Football Association. However, FIFA noted that only the Namibia Football Association shall control and supervise all forms of football at the national level. And now to Uganda, where the Federation of Uganda Football Association has announced a bonus of $3,500 for the Uganda under 17 girls. The team, which is so. And now to Uganda, where the Federation of Uganda Football Association has announced a bonus of $3,500 for the Uganda under 17 girls team ahead of their crucial 2021 FIFA under 17 Women World Cup playoff round qualifier against Cameroon in October. The financial support is expected to help players have effective personal training while waiting for the government to lift restrictions imposed on sports activities due to the health concerns caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The National Under-17 Women Team Head Coach Ayub Kalifan Kiigi has named a 35-strong team who will initially start with the individual training at home as FUFA lobbies government to allow the team to enter camp for residential training.
We are playing the giants of Africa in women's football. Cameroon is one of the strongest teams that we know. And we make it, and we have it in our mind that if the senior team is performing better, we also expect the junior team to perform better.
Staying with East Africa, Football Kenya Federation National Executive Committee aspirants for the upcoming elections, as well as the presidential aspirants, will this Monday present their nomination papers to FKF's Electoral Board. The national elections have been slated for October 17th, while those at the country level being held on September 19th. In South Sudan, Juma Stephen Luga, president of the South Sudan National Olympic Committee, says funding by the central government is key in their preparations for the 2021 Olympic Games. In Japan, some athletes from South Sudan who couldn't train because of the conflict or a lack of facilities in South Sudan have continued their training despite the postponement of the Olympics, with all their costs financed by donations from Japanese citizens. Back home in South Sudan, the president of the South Sudan National Olympic Committee, Juma Stephen, says they are yet to secure any financial commitment to fund their preparations for the Olympic Games. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, August 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte, wishing you a very good week.